I often say, like, it's important to recognize there's multiple ways into addiction. There really is. It's such a complex thing, because it's, and one of the reasons why it's so complex is because addiction, the behavior or the substance, whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs, whether it's an addictive behavior, food, phones, gambling, whatever it is, it's a lot of the time it's an escape. It, you're trying to avoid some kind of emotional and psychological pain. But there's other multiple ways into addiction as well.
Welcome to the Social Fabric podcast with me, Andrea Splendori. And this week I'll bring you a recording from a live podcast that I did with Dr. Brian Penny at the Whale Theatre in Greystones on the 29th of February 2024. The poem that I played before the show is read by Laura Wood, music by Mila Splendori Bell, and it's written by Maya Angelou. For more information and more episodes, please visit socialfabric.ie. If you like what you hear, please leave a review, a rating, and or share it. It'd be much appreciated. The title tune is Happy and Shining by the Randa About Us.
Lying, thinking last night. How to find my soul a home where water is not thirsty and bread loaf is not stone. I came up with one thing, and I don't believe I'm wrong, that nobody, but nobody, can make it out here alone. Alone. All alone. Nobody but nobody can make it out here alone. There are some millionaires with money they can't use. Their wives run round like banshees. Their children sing the blues. They've got expensive doctors to cure their hearts of stone. But nobody, no, nobody, can make it out here alone. Alone, all alone. Nobody, but nobody, can make it out here alone. Now, if you listen closely, I'll tell you what I know. Storm clouds are gathering. The wind is going to blow. The race of man is suffering. And I can hear the moan. 'Cause nobody, but nobody, can make it out here alone. Alone. All alone. Nobody, but nobody, can make it out here alone.
Tonight, I have a wonderful person to talk to you about addiction and connections, and that is Dr. Brian Penny. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you.
So, Brian, first of all, are you a real doctor or are you like Dr. Dre or something?
Apparently a real doctor. I don't know. Psychology, is it a real doctor? That's something for debate.
So, Brian, the first time we sat in front of each other with the microphone, I was looking it up, it was 4 years ago, 2019. 5 years ago, actually, 2019. And you weren't a doctor then. So what do you recall of that conversation we had?
God, that was my first podcast, my first ever podcast. I remember being quite nervous of the whole situation, and I think that's a good sign. Like, nerves are a good sign. You get a little bit anxious about things. But the one thing I remembered specifically about yourself, you were able to dig very deep and ask me questions that I hadn't thought about before. So that's the big part of the day. But I remember from yourself, I love the name, The Social Fabric. And just watching your journey since then has been really, really great, just seeing the guests that you've had on as well. So can't remember the individual details of the conversation. We did chat about it beforehand. I should have listened to it before we came, as you did. But you're saying I was looking for connection at the time, so that's quite interesting.
Yeah, I'm very disappointed you didn't listen to it again. Do some homework, will you? No, but it was really interesting because obviously your journey has changed since, and we'll talk about a little bit about that, because most of you would know Brian well, but maybe some of you don't, so we will put some context around this conversation. But yeah, is it me? Okay. No, it's Paul. But the one thing was, so that was 5 years ago, so you were, at the time, you were thinking of writing the book, right? But you were quite early out of your, you were early in your recovery. So the one thing you said to me, the inability to make connection, that was the words you used.
Yeah, I remember when I wrote the book. So one of the things from my own journey, so I'm 10 years into recovery from heroin addiction. And a big element of my journey was something happened. There was a shift in perspective. All of a sudden, this energy, this curiosity, this thirst to learn about the human mind came into me, every fiber of me being. It really did. And I had this hunger to learn. And I was intensely happy. Like, so there was whatever, I don't know what happened, the spiritual shift. Something changed. And all of a sudden, I felt great. But there was something missing. And I didn't know what. I didn't really know what it was. And I think it was this element of connection that I didn't have. And when you think about addiction, I'm actually quite obsessed around the relationship between addiction and connection, because addiction at its core is a drive to escape emotional and psychological pain. So I use drugs to anesthetize that pain. So I cut myself off from my own feelings. But when you cut yourself off from your feelings, we're emotional and social beings. So I really cut myself off from my connection with myself, and my connection then with other people at that intimate and that deep level. So I think when I found recovery, I had a bias towards positive feelings, but I wasn't really vulnerable. And it's really interesting when you interviewed me, because it was only when I start writing that book in 2019 and I start chatting with my family, who many of them are here tonight, and I got a deep sense of the pain I caused other people. And I just found it was a much greater connection there. On the back of that, I think that was the change for me of really getting into proper recovery, where I was getting deep and meaningful connections with people. They're the people I've loved for years, like me family, me mom and dad, me brothers and sisters. But that was around the time when I wrote the book as well that I met my partner, Natalie. She couldn't make it here tonight. She's not well. But I found love for the first time. I was nearly 40 years of age and I found love for the first time. And it was that sense of deep connection that just brought my whole life to a completely different realm. Like, it was just completely different. So for me, life is about our relationships with other people. It's about connection. It's about, like, what that poem really is. You can't do anything alone. Nothing meaningful comes from being alone. And that was the start of the journey for me.
Mm-hmm. And for those of you who haven't read Brian's book, it's called Bonus Time. And it's a wonderful book. And I was saying, not the easiest read for the topic that it is. And you said your family, some of your family are here, and thank you very much for making the trip from miles away, wherever you guys live, outside of Greystones. Thanks a million. I know there's a few of you from outside of Greystones. But that's what I was wondering. When I was reading the book, and I said, okay, that's wonderful, you're writing your story, but there's everybody else's story in there. What was it like to write that book and knowing that it's everybody else's story is also touched by?
That's a great question, because something I didn't know at the time, and my mom isn't here tonight actually, but I hadn't realised that my mom didn't tell anybody about the struggles that I was facing with addiction, like her own family and stuff like that. It was very obvious. If you see pictures of me, I was very obviously in addiction. I think alcohol sort of masked that over. So when I chatted to my mom and my family about writing the book,
I kind of asked for the permission. Like, I think I was sort of dead set on writing the book, but I was asking for permission about what I put into the book, and there was a couple of touchy topics of what I put in. But I hadn't realised at the time. My mum says, yeah, go along with it. Yeah, you can write that, you can write that. I got a sense that she wasn't comfortable with it, but I thought she was okay. So I sort of went and told the whole truth of everything that happened, warts and all. And so I think there was a little bit of pain there. But I think the truth will set you free. I think there's an element of that as well. The reality is, if I was to write it again, or if I could go back in time, I probably wouldn't have put it all out there, because I think my family are just, they're absolute heroes. They were like the cornerstone of my recovery. And for a long time, I didn't even recognize that. I think we were chatting beforehand. My family have my back so much that I am so dead certain that they will be there no matter what, that I nearly took it for granted. So it's only in the last 2 or 3 years that I've really recognized the fullness of that. They created the bedrock of everything that my recovery really stood on. So where I was probably a little bit more self-obsessed a couple of years ago, like, addiction is a self-obsessed game. You are always thinking about yourself or your pain to numb your pain. And there was still an element of that carrying on when I found recovery. So writing the book was really, really important. But even though I wrote things that I would probably take back, it was probably still the right move, because I think it brought a level of just greater intimacy with everyone as well. Like, because we just started talking about the challenges that was going on, and I think everyone in my family to an extent has found some kind of recovery or better sense of well-being throughout the whole process. Like, we've all done a lot of work together, so it was a joint effort, really, when you think about it.
And with, you know, 10 years sober, congratulations, it's well done, and it will last forever and ever, because you're now, the change has happened. You were talking about change is possible. The change is possible. That was it's still your tagline, right? Change is possible.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's when I met you, you were starting off with that change is possible. I actually remember I was listening to, that was your first gig you had as a speaker, which was really exciting, with one of the banks, and you've done hundreds of thousands since. But the interesting thing about, you were in addiction for a long time. That's, you know, how long were you an addict? I don't even know the word. What's the right word?
I don't know what word you're allowed to use these days, to be honest. I don't think you're allowed to say addict anymore, which is a funny one.
What would you use?
I use the word addict, whatever seems. I think I get mixed up with the language is changing day by day. But somebody that I struggled with addiction, that was the reality of it. But I often say, like, it's important to recognize there's multiple ways into addiction. There really is. It's such a complex thing. Because it's, and one of the reasons why it's so complex is because addiction, the behavior or the substance, whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs, whether it's an addictive behavior, food, phones, gambling, whatever it is, it's a lot of the time it's an escape. It's, you're trying to avoid some kind of emotional and psychological pain. But there's other multiple ways into addiction as well. But mine really came from trauma. So I had when I was born, I had a condition called intestinal malrotation. So basically my guts were twisted and I was getting very little nutrition into my body. But to cut a long story short, I had an operation for that surgery, but pre-1985, any infants that went for surgery did so without a general anesthetic. So it's quite shocking for some people to hear that. So I basically went under the knife, like, they inserted the scalpel and they gave me nothing more than a muscle relaxant to stop me squirming. And even when I talk about this 45 years later, I still have a little bit of an urge to rub the scar on my belly. Because what we know now today is that the body keeps the score. So years ago, pre-1985, they believed the infants wouldn't remember the situation, and I don't remember the operation. And they said they don't feel pain like normal adults. But what happened to me in that moment was, that was a traumatic event. And trauma is like one-time learning. My brain learned that the world is a dangerous place. I became a finely tuned anxiety machine, constantly scanning the world for future threats and danger. And that's literally what I became, constantly anxious, constantly on edge. I never felt safe in my body, always worrying, always tense. And it was, for me, when I started doing drugs, it was like I found my anesthetic that I'd always craved. And I'd done heroin for the first time. We were into Jim Morrison at the time, and Jim Morrison said, try everything once. So he says, okay, Jim, we'll try heroin once. And I did, and it wasn't once. I was 17 years of age, and I was kind of like, I kind of thought I was too good for addiction. I was too cute for addiction, I thought. So it was a couple of years before it really dragged me down, but it had me from the first moment. It was like it was waiting, it was biding its time because I knew I was being careful. But I had my first panic attack at 20 years of age, and I was slowly using heroin twice a week, three times a week. And the panic attack raised my baseline anxiety to a level I just couldn't handle. And I justified that as a way, right, I have to do heroin. It's the only way. And obviously not a very valid justification. So from 20 to 35 years of age, I was chronically addicted to heroin.
That's for anything is a long time. Mm. But for heroin, now you're a fit man. We went for a walk a couple of weeks ago. A hike, as somebody calls it. And Brian's a little bit smaller than me, and our friend, the tall fellow, was with us as well. And he's even bigger. But Brian was wearing what looked like a bulletproof vest. It was the scariest thing, but he actually carries 20 kilos. So you're 65 kilos, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
And on top of that, he had 20 kilos, so a third of his body weight, and still weighed a lot less than me. So you were into fitness, you were into football, but 15 years on heroin, what does that do to your body?
God, I remember when I got clean, because it was heroin addiction. At the end, it was just, I was taking, God, at the very end, I was taking 15, 20 tablets a day. Like, I was waking up and taking 10 sleeping tablets just to function. Like, it was, my biology was totally reversed. 100 mils of methadone, heroin, vodka, just anything to numb that pain. So the amount of drugs I was putting into my body was scary when I think back on it. And I remember going to the doctor early in recovery, and I says, look, there has to be damage to my body. There has to be damage. What's going on? And the way he described it to me, he was just a GP. Not just a GP, he was a GP. But he described it to me, and whether I believe him or not, I like his metaphor, but he says, it was like you were driving at 100 miles an hour. You were in severe danger of crashing and killing yourself. We are back to 30 miles an hour. And as long as you keep doing that, you'll be okay. Now, he was probably just trying to make me feel better, I'm not too sure, but when you look at the research, there's atrophy in the brain. Like, I done a PhD in neuroscience, and there is atrophy within the brain. I actually have a brain scan, because when I was in detox, I was part of a study for looking at the impact of methadone on long-term addiction. And so I got a scan of my brain, and I made comparisons over time. But the brain is an incredible thing. Like, through neuroplasticity, the plastic brain, we can change our brains. And I was able to get a scan later than that and see incredible changes over time. So we can go into that. We'll be talking about neuroscience later. So there was definitely damage. There had to have been damage. But I think the body is an incredible thing. Like, the liver completely recovers. And I just think there is so much that we can actually do as long as we take the steps, like whether it's exercise, eating healthy, sleeping. Over time, we can really recover the body, and I think that's just what I've done.
That's amazing, because for those 15 years you held down a job. You had a good job.
Yeah, it was. I was a functional addict. It's really interesting, because a lot of people often think of addiction as this stereotypical train spotting story, especially heroin addiction. But that's not the case at all. It's really not. Like, I worked as a graphic artist in the pharmaceutical industry, ironically designing methadone and anti-anxiety medication.
Hold on, sorry.
For Big Pharma.
Hold on, are you serious?
Yeah.
That's actually a true story.
That's a true story.
Tell us more before you carry on.
Yeah, so I'd be literally sitting at my desk, because, like, I was very aware. I mean, my job was one of the biggest funders of my addiction, so keeping my job was a big priority. For many reasons, paying the bills, but addiction was in the driving seat. But I would literally go in, I'd take some drugs to take the edge off, but I would be in pain, I'd be suffering, I'd need more drugs. My body was screaming for more drugs to feel normal. And I would be going in, and I'd be designing methadone labels for Pinewood Healthcare and AnxiCam for the different companies. And I'd be sitting there saying, why wasn't he in the manufacturing plants? Maybe I could have had a sneaky dip, you know? But yeah, true story.
Wow, I didn't know. We didn't go into that last time. Maybe we could have written Dope Sick and we could have made a fortune.
Yeah, I tell you.
But jokes aside, I mean, I don't know, any of us that experience hangover or whatever, it's just really hard to get up in the morning to go to work and function. But for 15 years, tell me a little bit about the chemical aspect of that. How do you, you mentioned you're taking 20 tablets, Valium or whatever it is, you know, which are downers to keep you going. I don't get that.
It doesn't even make sense, and I don't know how I still function. Like, to be quite honest, I didn't function. I call myself a functional addict, and I remember saying that out loud for the first time when people from my old job were in the crowd, and I just had this sudden realization. I started laughing and looking at the faces of the people that worked with me. I wasn't very functional at all, to be quite honest. I was falling asleep on the job. I was quite good when I was awake. But the basic requirement of working in a job is being awake, like, you know, not being asleep. But again, the connection, we come back to connection. So I worked in a company and there was just great people in the company and it was a real family environment. And call it enabling, it was enabling, but they protected me from getting sacked. They always looked out for me. So even when the quality auditors were coming in, because there's a big difference between 5.0 milligrams and 50 milligrams, I'm half asleep on the computer. So the quality teams from these pharma companies will be coming in and the guys will be like, hide Brian in the dark room, because they're looking out for me. Like, that was the reality of it. So they were looking out for me, but it was very problematic at the same time because it kept me in the depths of addiction. And I was only chatting to someone recently, a guy called Pat Smith. He was a manager in the job. He tried to get me sacked on several occasions. He was a bit of a... He's a really good bloke. He was known as a bully at manager who used to really try to cause problems within the job. But to be honest, he was just doing his job for the right reasons when I look back. And he sort of read my story and he used to feel guilty. He said it to me in an email recently. I felt guilty because I tried to get you sacked. But now that I've heard your story and around enabling and stuff like that, I wish I got you sacked. And that was the reality of it. Like, it was true. Like, but maybe I would have, God knows what would have happened. And this was the journey I was on and it happened this way. And I'm very grateful for where I am now. But
Now, in fairness, I don't know much about medicine label, but it doesn't take that much to design one of them, does it?
No, not really.
I'm only messing. I'm sure it's a big job. But the one thing you said to me last time we spoke about this, you said the only reason you stayed in the job for that long because people thought you were an alcoholic.
Yeah, and this is the reality with Ireland especially because I remember there was one guy, a very senior manager, and he would have been like what we'd call a dipso in Ireland. He liked his drinks. And he used to protect me. He used to say, ah, Brian just likes to have a few drinks. Sure, we're all like that. And I think they didn't know I was a heroin addict. They thought it was just alcohol. And if they were to try to get rid of me on the basis of me drinking too much, they'd be shining the light on themselves as well. So I think that's an element in the Irish. It's probably all over the world. We say Ireland is worse. I don't know how true that even is. But they thought I was a functional alcoholic. That's a kind of accepted thing in Ireland. And that's what protected me, to be quite honest. And it was only when we merged with another company, new people came in who didn't know me, and they basically just says, what the hell is going on with that guy? Like, there's something seriously wrong there. That's not normal. That's not right. And he put in a lot of complaints. And when I went down to actually, it was when I was going down to protect my job, so there was loads of complaints about me falling asleep, and Brian, you're not functioning. We're going to have to look into this. And my two managers were the shop stewards, you know, they were the union reps as well. So we basically went for a meeting with the two factory managers for me to save my job. And I just remember walking into this meeting. I wrote about this in the book. I went into the meeting. I thought it went well. I came out after the meeting and I says to Wayne, I says, I think that went okay, did it? And he looked at me and he says, Brian, you fell asleep. So for the meeting for me to save my job for going to sleep, I literally went in, my head went on the table. They're all sitting there looking at me saying, what the hell is going on? I literally fell asleep. So that's what had to happen to me to actually for them to say, right, enough is enough. Like, it's extreme as you're going to guess. So that sort of identity of alcohol sort of masking the problem was very, very real.
I just want to bring you back a minute before we talk about recovery and then we'll take a break and we'll talk about neuroscience afterwards. But when we were talking about, when I was reading your book, it was really interesting, your story in Blanchardstown, an area of Blanchardstown. Ladieswell?
Ladieswell, yeah.
And as I was reading it, I could really relate to it. We both love football. We were both very good at it. Nobody else knows, but we were both very good at it. You had an injury. I didn't. I stayed very good. But the problem was, at the time, like, I lived in a beautiful little town outside of Rome, idyllic. And there's a whole lot of kids, like your kids, the Ladies Well team and the Roma team. And by the time we got to 14 years of age, half of my, we couldn't field a five-a-side pitch, a five-a-side team anymore, because more than a half of my friends ended up on heroin, with the latter, as you call it. They started smoking, then they started doing cannabis, ganja, whatever you call it, hashish, and then ended up on heroin. So we lost half of the team, literally lost, you know, some of them didn't survive the 18 years of age, some of them recovered. But that was very much your story there, like you, a group of kids kicking the ball. And so it happens everywhere. It's not, doesn't matter whether it's Rome, Ladyswell, or anywhere else. But what do you recall of all of that? What was the thing in, because you mentioned your good friend, Gar, and he's still your good friend, which is fantastic. But, you know, tell me what you recall of that time.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because I was obsessed with football, and I remember a couple of my friends at 14, they were starting to smoke cigarettes and all, and I remember just being angry with them, like, so why would you do that to yourself for? Like, it's so stupid. But there must have been, that's the age when curiosity sets in, and I remember I got that injury, I'll never forget it, and I was on the dressing rooms, we're on the roof of the dressing rooms, just messing around as young kids. I was injured at the time, and one of my friends was taught, he had a roll-up Samson tobacco cigarette. And he says, oh, you get a great head buzz out of that. And it was the head buzz that interested me. So I don't know why I says, let me try that, because I was really anti-smoking. And I just loved that head buzz. And it was within a couple of weeks I was smoking hash, taking tablets, and something just, I think it was the trauma I suffered. I got a relief out of the drugs. But I didn't have a switch where I said, some people will say, right, I'll smoke hash, but I won't take tablets. I'll take tablets, but I wouldn't do cocaine. I'll do cocaine, but I wouldn't do heroin. There's like an moment. I just didn't seem to have that. And for me, it was this kind of self-delusion. I think there's a thin line between self-delusion and self-belief. I cross it regularly. I still do. To be quite honest, I think you need a bit of both of them, to be quite honest, to push yourself forward in the world. You need to fake it to an element to put yourself out there. But I fundamentally believe that couldn't happen to me. And it's as I mentioned already, like I done heroin, I start, I loved it. It got its claws into me very early, but I fundamentally didn't believe I could be an addict. I was different somehow. But that's just over time, it dug its claws in deeper and deeper until it was just too late. I heard a great line recently. I don't know where it came from, but it's like addiction at the start, that's like a chain that's too light to feel until it's too heavy to break free. And that's really something that resonated with me. Like, the chain is too light and you can't even feel it. You don't think you're addicted. But then all of a sudden it just has you and you just cannot break free. It's really, it's a crazy thing. And I think you really need to experience that to know what it's like when it really gets its claws in like that.
Now, you mentioned trauma a few times and you shared with us that when you were born and the pain and sounds horrific. And as you say, the body keeps the score. Where is that trauma now?
I believe I fundamentally dealt with that trauma, to be quite honest. Like, anxiety and panic attacks drove my entire addiction. They were the core. Like, I had a fundamental narrative, a belief system. I can't cope with anxiety. I need drugs to survive. The narrative today is adversity doesn't stop me. It gives me the fuel to learn and grow. So I've used the biggest challenges in my life. All of the greatest challenges in my life have turned into the greatest learning opportunities. They really have. And I love that line. There's a Zen proverb, like, obstacles don't block the path. They are the path. And the trauma and, like, anxiety, it was a teacher. It really was. Like, I have a beautiful relationship with anxiety today. It's a crazy thing to say. Like, I still get anxious. Obviously, I hope I do. If something bad happens, you need anxiety. You need stress. They're just signals. They're not bad things. But it's an ability to be able to deal with that. Like, if I was feeling very anxious, I can lean into a toolbox, whether it's breath work, whether it's exercise, whatever I need in that moment. And I can sort of navigate that anxiety. I can play with anxiety. Like, it's not something that bothers me in any way. So it's being able to have a toolbox to deal with those challenges. And trauma is just the same. Like, trauma is a physical energy. It's a crazy energy within the body. And every time I talk about having that scar in my belly, I can feel a little bit of it. Like a sensation, like a need to touch the scar. But, like, I couldn't even touch that scar for years into my early years of recovery. I couldn't even think about that scar. It was like I was averse and it was an energy that was there. So over time, I've done body work, I've done inner child work, I've sort of held that little infant and cradled him in my arms and says, right, I have you now, everything is okay, it's all good. And I've really just sort of, through neuroscientific techniques as well and therapeutic techniques, I've changed my relationship with that pain. Now, what I would say, if anyone has experienced trauma, I wouldn't advise you to do this on your own, to do it with other people or touch off the edges of it. Don't go deep, because trauma can be a really powerful source of pain. But it's, I've just gotten to the depths with it, and it's something that you've got to feel it. You've got to be aware of it, and you've got to sort of sit with that pain. But it's you're always learning. There's always something new. Like, I'm sure I learned new things in the past. So it's being open, being aware, and constantly vigilant, I suppose, as well, to what's going on and what other changes it'll arise going forward.
So just to stay for a moment with a bit of chronology before we have a break. So you fall asleep, you lose your job. I hope you lost your job.
Yeah.
Because
yes. I did.
No, at that stage, you would have had to, you know, otherwise this story wasn't going to carry on. We were going to get somebody else on stage. So you lost the job. Brilliant. It was a bad time because you fell asleep on it. How and when did you get into recovery? What happened? What was the pivotal moment?
So that was the catalyst for everything, because I remember my family saying, go into treatment. And I says, I can't. I owe out too much money. This was the excuse I was telling people. Now, I was in tens of thousands of euro of debt to drug dealers, money lenders, banks. I used to get credit cards for heroin loans, like crazy debt I was in. And I says, I can't leave my job. But when I got sacked, heroin had turned its back on me. The drugs weren't working anymore. I had no job to fund my addiction. I sold drugs to fund my addiction at one stage. I would do anything to fund the addiction. But even people, drug dealers, wouldn't trust me to sell drugs even. Like, I got to the stage where nobody trusted me. I wasn't used to anybody. I couldn't function in any way. I was completely broken. And even my family, who are incredible, they had to pull back to protect themselves. That's where it went. It went to the depths of addiction. And I went, when I lost my job and everything happened, I says, right, I'm going to have to try to break free. But I didn't want to break free from drugs, because I didn't think I could live with anxiety. So I wanted to go into a treatment center to get clean and then try to do a smarter and better. But I obviously still needed drugs. But on the back of that, I ended up doing a detox at home on my own, because there wasn't a bed available for 4 months. I'd done a benzo detox at home on my own, and I had what's called a grand mal convulsive seizure. So my brother, who's here in the audience there, he was minding me through the withdrawals, and I had a seizure on the ground. And when you have a seizure, you convulse in pain. So what happened was I actually bit my tongue. I split my tongue down the center, blood everywhere. I had a seizure. I was rushed to hospital, and I remember just being absolutely broken, lying down in Blanchardstown Hospital. And I had an experience with a fire extinguisher. Crazy thing to say, an experience with a fire extinguisher. Glad I didn't say relationship, an experience with a fire extinguisher. But where I remember in Blanchardstown Hospital staring at this fire extinguisher on the wall, and I didn't know what it was. And I felt like I had a bag of needles in my mouth. I was emotionally, physically, and mentally broken. I just got rushed by an ambulance to the hospital. Near-death experience on the back of a detox from a 15-year addiction. And I was in such a bad way. And I remember looking at this fire extinguisher hanging on the wall, and I didn't know what it was. And I started to get this sort of feeling in the pit of my stomach. Something is seriously wrong here. What's going on? And I was looking around the room, trying to make sense of the room, and I couldn't make sense. I couldn't cognitively label my environment. And I remember thinking to myself, oh my God, that's brain damage. You've destroyed your brain. Game over. No coming back from this. And in that moment, I was waiting to be overwhelmed by panic and anxiety, everything that drove my entire addiction. But I remember just saying to myself, I can't do this anymore. I can't fight this anymore. I give in. And I remember just leaning back down on the trolley, waiting to be overwhelmed, but I felt a sense of peace. And I genuinely believe, what I retrospectively realized, that was the first moment in my life that I ever surrendered. I stopped fighting anxiety. I stopped resisting reality. I put up the white flag, and I says, I give in. I'm done. I stopped the fight. And something shifted there. And I believe that moment of surrender, that moment of letting go, that that was the shift that completely changed my life. And it was after that, I just knew I'd never do drugs again. It's a crazy thing to say, but I just knew. I didn't even want to do drugs again. I knew I wouldn't do drugs again. And it was like I was looking at the world through a different lens. It was like the lights came on and I was like, what the hell was I doing? Like, it was a moment of awareness. I don't know whether it was spiritual, if you believe in that, dumb luck. I've no idea, but I've never looked back. And I'm eternally grateful for whatever the hell happened, because it was, it just gave me a platform to just live an incredible life. And again, back to my family, back to connection. It was the perfect storm for whatever happened to me. I was set up in a way where I was interested in academia. I was interested in the human mind. I was interested in learning. I had a phenomenal support network to help me through the early days. And it just really, really grew legs from there.
Mm. And I just want to pay tribute to your family that are here, because you mentioned your brother is there when you're biting your tongue. Now, it's a scary experience for anybody, especially if you're younger, older brother, it doesn't matter. Your brother is lying on the floor. What do you remember at that moment? I know you remember the fire extinguisher, but do you remember anything else?
So I don't, and it's really funny. Like, I wrote my book and I've talked to my family about those experiences. So sometimes I get mixed up. Are they my memories? Are they their memories? Have I rewrote the story in some way? So I think I was pretty much out cold. So you slump at the end of a seizure. So I slumped. My brother James thought I was dead. He rang me dad and said, I think Brian's dead. I remember coming to. I remember being in the hospital, or being in the ambulance, going down the ambulance. I think my sister was with me, going down in the ambulance. And I've just glimpses of memories, but I think of other people's memories. I don't really know what the experience was, but I remember the fire extinguisher incident as if it was just so vivid. Mm. And I remember the colors of the walls. They were this dirty orange brown. I remember a light flickering in the corridor. I have this really vivid memory of being in the hospital. And again, I've done a PhD in psychology. We don't even know if our memories are real. That's the reality of it. That's what I believe to be the memory, and it's quite vivid. But it's whatever it was, I'm eternally grateful for it. Again, it was one of the most difficult moments of my life, but it was a moment that helped me to grow in so many ways.
So let's leave it on a high note. Right. So you've been fired. You're nearly near death experience. You survive because you're here. 4 months at home must be really tough for you and the family. Where is the final chapter in that you just finally come out? What did you come out of? Is it a center you went to afterwards?
Yeah, I went to a detox facility. So the benzos were out of my system and I had to go and do a heroin detox. And I don't know what you're supposed to be feeling going through a heroin detox, but after that shift, something had changed, and I went to that detox with a sense of hope. And when I landed there, it was a little farm on the outskirts of Dublin. I start talking to a psychologist for the first time. I start meditating for the first time. I start reading books about self-awareness and Eastern philosophy, and I was just captivated by these ideas. How have I never heard of these ideas before? And that's where the journey started for me. I'm often asked if I could go back to one time in my life, when would it be? And it's 2 days before my first day clean. I was in the depths of a methadone detox, much worse than a heroin detox, in the depths of that detox. But reading all of these books and just coming alive again, I numbed my emotions for so long. So it was like my body and my mind and my brain and my emotions were just coming back alive. They were waking up again. And although I was in such physical pain and I had a fever from the detoxing off the drugs, it was just a phenomenal experience. It really was. And yeah, it just, that set the scene for me. And I just knew I was going to study psychology. I remember I had a journal with me while I was in detox and I was writing in the journal. And I thought it was brain damaged, which was really interesting. And it was a woman called Professor Johanna Ivers came into the detox center to do a brain study. And I still thought I had been brain damaged and there was an element of damage done and something wrong. But when she came in, she was asking me questions before I went for the brain scan. And I was preempting the other questions. And she turned around to me and she says, "You have a very sharp mind." And I says, when she left, I says, "God, if she thinks of a sharp mind, maybe I'm not brain damaged. Maybe I could even go to college." And something was sparked inside of me there, because I wrote it in my diary, follow your passion, go to college, because I knew society would be telling me, and even my family, they wanted to look out for me, do something safe, don't do something mad and go to college, you're only at coming out as long addiction. And I can understand that, but I just knew that I needed to do that. And it turned out that Johanna gave me a job teaching the neuroscience of addiction at Trinity College 4 years after that. So that was a nice circular moment. I'm still teaching the neuroscience of addiction in Trinity there. But yeah, that was just the start of everything. And I was just like, I was so rewarded by learning about the human mind. And it just set me off on a journey. It was just an incredible journey. It really was.
Fantastic. And I would like to leave it at that. And I would like to, first of all, congratulations on the 10 years. And congratulate your family for standing by you. And we'll see you in 15 minutes. Don't have a drink.
Thank you for listening to the Social Fabric podcast with me, Andrea Splendori, and please join me again for part two of my conversation with Dr. Brian Penny. If you haven't already, I would appreciate if you could subscribe, share, and review. Waiting to shine, this friend of mine. Moonlight washed by a glass of red wine. I'm doing fine if you tell me why. Yeah, I'm doing okay. My new cover design. Shining like a sunny day now. We left some dreams broken on the floor. Happy and shining like a sunny day now. We'll never give up, just looking for. Thank you.
Sunny day.